You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Some corporate leaders have been comparing themselves to civil rights leaders and their lawlessness to civil disobedience, all while violating some civil rights. How are the new corporate leaders at Uber, Google, and Airbnb operating outside of the rule of law, and how is it affecting societies? With us is Siva Vaidyanathan. He is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia and the author of The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Welcome back to the Scholar's Circle. It's great to have you back here again. Last time we had you on was for your book, The Googleization of Everything. So I wondered, before we get into this latest opinion piece that you wrote, if you could write the latest epilogue for that book, what would it say?
What I was trying to do with The Googleization of Everything was get people to think about the ways that Google affects our lives and what it means to outsource so many important decisions in our daily life to one company's algorithms, to trust a company so deeply that decisions about what is true, what is good, what is beautiful, what tastes good, what the best recipe is, all of these things, we deeply trust Google to the point that we just automatically respond to its response to us. And it's a really fascinating, complex feedback mechanism, a constant conversation between ourselves and Google, not just on an individual level, but on a collective level. So the fact that this is the most fascinating company in the world, perhaps the most fascinating company in the history of the world, was good enough for me. But I really wanted people to understand just how wacky this whole thing is. In this very short period of time, we've done this. Now, that phenomenon has not changed. A lot of what Google does in daily life has changed. So, for instance, by 2011, when that book came out, I had no way of discussing the fact that Google, now Alphabet, was very interested in generating a self-driving car, building off of the Maps and GPS project that it had brought in, and then creating a vehicle that could navigate itself around the world. That's mind-blowing. That's controversial. That's certainly worthy of policy debates and ethical debates and all sorts of other debates. Right now, I would obviously have to write about that, but I would encapsulate everything in a bigger idea that I wish had occurred to me back then, and that is the operating system of our lives. Because when I look at the big information companies in the world, I look at Facebook, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and Apple. All of these companies basically do their own thing, and they're all making the money that they can, in many cases big money, with the exception of Amazon, which barely breaks even. And they're doing so without necessarily directly competing, although Facebook and Amazon compete for advertisements, and Facebook and Google compete for advertisements online, and Apple and Google compete to be the operating system of our mobile devices, right? Those are the intersections of competition. But for the most part, they could all stay in their lanes and continue to print money, and everyone would be very happy with all their shareholders and employees would be very happy. But they all seem to be doing so much more. They all seem to have these grand ambitions. And so I was trying to unpack those grand ambitions and try to make sense of it. And from their starting points, they all are striving to become the operating system of our lives. They all want to manage the data flow that they see coming to our home appliances, to our automobiles, to our clothing, to our eyeglasses, to our home entertainment systems. So Google, for instance, buys Nest, a company best known for smart thermostats. Google buys a robot company, a mind-blowing robot company from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Facebook tries to become a more important part of our lives, tries to be the central point for sending text messages to everybody. You know, every move Facebook tries is to become a bigger, deeper part of our consciousness. Apple is trying so many different things with new devices to be the operating system of our lives. And whoever wins this, it's going to have a tremendous amount of power in the world. And chances are, because of standardization, that company, maybe two companies, will have a monopoly or oligopoly over far more than our digital lives, over far more than web advertising. You know, the idea of the web might not even matter anymore if we're talking about, you know, pure information dumps and downloads to our skin, to our eyes, you know, to our vehicles, to our homes. And so that idea, the operating system of our lives, I think if I could do a new version today, that's how I would frame the big idea that Google's after, because that's also something shared with all these other companies.
And probably most importantly, to our brains.
Right. And that's what's really interesting. You know, when I say the operating system of our lives, you could probably substitute that phrase for the more common phrase you hear in daily conversation and in news reports, and that is the Internet of Things. I can't stand the phrase the Internet of Things because it's neither an internet nor about things. The internet is an open, customizable, malleable system where, in theory, we are all supposed to have the ability to interact with it and openly contribute to the wealth and structure and code of it if we need to. That's what's fascinating about it and unique about it in human history. Whatever's coming, this digital stream that is going to have to be, it seems, controlled top down by one or more of a hand of these companies, is not going to be anything like the internet. It's going to be a tightly controlled, as secure as possible, totally privatized set of network interactions that will have nothing to do with the internet. It won't look or feel like the internet at all. And it won't be about things. It'll be about bodies and minds. It'll be about humans. It really is about connecting us and our lives. And all those things around us, our cars, our thermostats, our homes, those are merely, as Marshall McLuhan said, extensions of ourselves. You know, our homes are merely extensions of our skin, because our skin can't provide protection from the elements. And so we created a technology called clothes that are an extension of our clothes. And when that was insufficient, we created another extension, which is an abode, a hut, or a modern, you know, mini mansion outside of Houston. When it comes right down to it, if you're talking about data flows controlling our home or our cars, it really is about controlling our bodies, plugging our bodies into electronic feedback loops, vast data sets, and algorithms that we're not allowed to understand.
Facebook in particular is the one that I find the most fascinating because of the amount of time, and it's sort of like capsule within which people live.
Well, they wish. Right? Facebook wishes it were all that. What's really interesting is, for a time, it looked like that's where we were headed, into a situation where, at least when it comes to our social interactions, we learn about the world. Facebook was growing in dominance. You know, look, it still has 1 billion users, which is amazing, and it's growing like crazy in important places like India and Brazil. But it's kind of tapped out in terms of penetration in the U.S. Young people, I can tell you from firsthand knowledge, find Facebook to be essential but not complete. Their communicative lives and social lives are so much more rich and supplemented by WeChat if they're global citizens, or Snapchat if they're local citizens, or Instagram, which of course Facebook owns. So their social networks and social systems are not exclusive to Facebook anymore, which, you know, drives Facebook crazy. It's one of the reasons Facebook is constantly trying new things to give people a reason just to hang out in the Facebook interface a bit longer than they already do. Facebook would love to be the place you search for restaurant recommendations and recipes rather than how you use Google right now. Facebook would love to be your news feed about the world the way that people use Twitter now. So Facebook is a fascinating company in itself. I think it's kind of topping off right now. It hasn't made the bold moves it wanted to make. It tried to create an operating system for mobile devices. It tried to make the Facebook app so central that they hoped you wouldn't need other apps on a mobile device. That hasn't worked out. And I'm not sure they know what their next move is, although it looks like virtual reality might be the thing they're betting on. They have purchased the most interesting virtual reality companies around, and they might actually want to be an immersive entertainment source through virtual reality. So we'll see how that goes. And Microsoft is after the same thing. They're also very aggressive in trying to get into virtual reality right now.
Now let's move to this other piece that you have been looking at, which deals with the so-called sharing economy. You wrote this piece in The Guardian called Uber and the Lawlessness of Sharing Economy Corporates.
Very, very British usage there in the in the headline, right?
Right. Maybe the place to start is we call them sharing economies, but isn't that a misnomer?
Right. Totally. First of all, economy is a bit too grandiose here. You know, we're talking about a handful of businesses that have certainly made an impression on the world and have inspired other people to model new companies after them and have affected the daily lives of a lot of people who live in urban areas and can afford smartphones and the data that goes along with them, which is not an insubstantial number or class of people, but it is still fairly limited. If you don't have a smartphone, you're not using Uber anyway. If you don't have a credit card, you're not using Uber anyway. You know, and if you're not a sophisticated user of digital platforms, you're not using Airbnb. And so while both of these companies now have global reach with certain pockets that have been shut off to them by regulation, to say that it's an economic phenomenon is a bit of a stretch right now. It's an interesting marginal phenomenon which has almost no effect on GDP anywhere, but it's certainly worthy of examination because culturally I think these things are fascinating.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We're talking with Siva Vaidyanathan about the new corporate lawlessness and what it is doing to societies across the globe. The other part that perhaps is a misnomer is the idea that it's really sharing that much because still big corporations.
If I borrow my roommate's car for a date, that's sharing. The Uber guy is not going to let me borrow his car. There's no share going on here. It is a taxi service, and it's a particularly structured taxi service. It's a particularly efficient way of distributing the resource of ride granting to a mobile population that has certain surge moments of demand. And so, you know, the algorithmic and data-driven innovations are fascinating in and of themselves, and certainly a lot of other companies are trying to learn from that. But no, there's no sharing going on. Airbnb is a lot more like sharing than Uber. They don't actually have anything in common, except that they're both threatening the status quo of how cities govern themselves. Cities around the world have, for years, done their best to regulate and tax hotel rooms, regulate and tax taxi services. And in both those cases, Uber and Airbnb are undermining those efforts. And that's really where the debate is. There are arguments, good arguments, for the case that Uber and Airbnb are exposing and undermining regulatory systems that are archaic, anti-competitive, bad for consumers. That's, you know, an argument on that plane is fine. And then the argument that Frank Pasquale and I made in that article in The Guardian is the opposite, which is let's not assume that all of these regulations around the world that govern these institutions are illegitimate or improper. It's really up to the people of Paris and the people of St. Petersburg and the people of Manila and the people of Delhi and the people of New York and the people of San Francisco to decide what regulatory system they want to have for these sorts of services, to decide how revenue should be grabbed, to decide whether their methods of regulation are legitimate and proper and whether there might be a better way. But instead of having those sorts of reasoned debate with real policy analysis and then ultimately calm deliberation, which, you know, may be a fantasy anyway, we're seeing what Frank Pasquale and I call corporate nullification. And this was the idea. Frank is a law professor at the University of Maryland, and he wrote a brilliant book called The Black Box Society that just came out this spring. And this book examines the ways that algorithms run our lives, from insurance and banking through search engines and social networks, and the fact that there's so much unaccountability there. And so he and I were thinking along the same lines over the past few months as we watched Uber get into conflict after conflict in New York, in Paris, in London, elsewhere. And as we followed this news, we started conversing a bit, and I brought up this phrase. I said, what about corporate nullification? Because it seems like in California, Uber's making the case that labor laws do not apply to it because it's new and special. So if you're claiming laws do not apply to you, you know, that's kind of a nullification move. That's a way of saying this law isn't relevant, and the justification for that is sort of the opposite of the conservatism that informed Southern slaveholders and segregationists when they tried to nullify federal laws, which was, this is how we've always done things. So from a conservative point of view, you know, a traditional point of view, corporate nullification of this kind is, these laws are irrelevant to us because they're not about the future, and we're about the future, and we're about innovation, a word I hate, you know. And so the rhetorical field for this debate is so bad right now that if you're against Uber, you're against the future. Well, that's no way to start a conversation and figure out the best way to have these things. Maybe having services like Uber and Lyft is good for cities around the world, maybe not all cities. Maybe some cities, you know, maybe it's a great thing in San Francisco and not such a good thing in New York. Maybe it's a great thing in Los Angeles and not in Seattle. Maybe it's a great thing in London and not Paris. So our argument was, you know, look, regulations are important. You can't just sweep them away and assume that it's about incumbent industries capturing them and protecting themselves. That does happen, but you don't know that for sure. This is a good opportunity to have those fights out. So that's where the idea of corporate nullification came down. Unfortunately, I had Frank working on these issues from his point of view as a legal scholar who thinks a lot about algorithms, and then I was able to work through it back and forth with him. And you know, The Guardian really dug the idea, and we're really proud of the article. It managed to get a lot of conversation going, a lot of debate going. The concept of corporate nullification, I think, has legs in a lot of different areas beyond Airbnb and Google and Uber, the three companies we mentioned, you know, but as corporations grow in power and political power, if you can imagine them getting more powerful than they are today, we are looking at the potential moment in human history where we are coming back to the moment of the British East India Company and the Dutch East India Company operating as quasi-states, making up their own rules, having their own instruments of power, and being virtually immune to the regulatory systems and wishes of the local populations they affect. And we should be worried about that potential. We have lots of historical examples of concentrated corporate power being that bold. And one of the reasons that we created the modern state in the 20th century was to curb the excesses of such powerful institutions. One of the reasons Adam Smith wrote On the Wealth of Nations was to undermine the status of those big multinational corporations that were essentially in restraint of trade. They were messing with people's ability to seek out the good life for themselves. They were having values imposed on them. And Frank and I both see similar echoes in our current political economy and political rhetoric.
You just mentioned also that Google is among them with these sort of corporate nullification efforts. And in your article, you noted that one of the ways in which Google does this is with privacy laws, with copyright laws. Give us a little description of how this looks and update us with some of the lawsuits.
Sure. Well, Google Street View is a program that started around 2005. Google started sending its cars around to streets in the world with cameras mounted on top, taking 360-degree images of as many streets as they could drive down. And in the United States, people thought it was kind of cool and kind of harmless, and nobody really protested. There was one lawsuit from a couple outside of Pittsburgh because the Google car drove up their driveway and took pictures of their house. That lawsuit was tossed out pretty fast. But, you know, Google has pretty clearly violated privacy laws in much of Europe where you are not supposed to take pictures of people for commercial purposes without their permission, in general, in most countries in Europe. And the very fact that the images themselves were just so hard to police and patrol for people, and there were lots of images of children and some images of children naked and images of people doing embarrassing things. And what happened was European privacy regulators tried to crack down on Google, and in some places they managed to. But for the most part, Google's MO was shoot pictures first and ask questions later, ask permission later, or don't ask permission. Like, flip the default. Google would go around shooting all these pictures and then create a service that it hoped would be so popular that the regulators could not crush it because there would be a popular uproar. That was the assumption. That's what it tried to do with Google Book Search, too. When it started scanning in all of these copyrighted books, it knew it was going to face lawsuits from publishing companies and authors, but it figured it would create such an important, valuable, interesting service that it would have the gut feeling of a good thing going for it. And it actually worked. So ultimately, at this point in time, Google has prevailed in its lawsuits, in the lawsuits that the publishers brought against it, at least in the United States. So it's a really fascinating thing where Google just says, look, I'm going to roll out something. I know it breaks the law, or at least is going to invite a lawsuit, but we're going to rewrite the law through practice because we think we're doing something so super popular, so transformative, so revolutionary, so innovative, that there'll be enough popular will behind it to let it survive in some form. And for the most part, Google has managed to do that. So I think Google sort of set the standard for this, although you know, could argue that Napster tried to do that with its service to find MP3s on people's computers. Napster's position was, well, let's make this thing so super popular that the music business, sure, music business could sue us out of business, but won't it just kind of figure, isn't it better to settle and figure out how to monetize this thing? Of course, the music business wasn't smart enough to take that bait and instead crushed Napster as a company, but never crushed the concept of file sharing, and it missed out on a brilliant opportunity. So, you know, we've seen this time and time again, and now we're seeing it with Uber and Airbnb, where they are marching into a town and saying, you know, forget the regulations, we're special, we're new, and we're going to become so popular that if regulators, like the mayor of New York, for instance, Bill de Blasio, want to take a stand and say, you know what, we are really concerned about traffic congestion in Manhattan, and we have no way of regulating traffic congestion in Manhattan with this many cabs, because there are so many new Uber cabs out there, we need to put a stop to it, or at least manage the traffic better. And then Uber was able to create a AstroTurf popular uprising among, you know, wealthy Uber users to stop de Blasio's efforts to re-regulate the system. So it's just been chaos.
A couple of other aspects that you brought up in that piece, juxtaposing this argument that they're like civil rights leaders using this civil disobedience, when in fact, in many ways, they're doing the opposite. Uber's facing a lawsuit from an organization that represents blind people because of how much they refuse to pick up blind people. And so it's sort of the antithesis of civil rights organizations, and yet they're trying to put forward that that is their ethos. The other thing I wanted to bring up is now how many corporates are using these systems like Airbnb, for example, big landlords using Airbnb but kicking out their longtime tenants because they make more money by renting out their rooms on the Airbnb system.
You know, that's a really scary phenomenon. But, you know, look, landlords in big cities, big congested cities with high rents and that are popular tourist distractions have long tried to find ways to kick out long-term residents. So using Airbnb for it, I think, says more about the landlord problem than it does about the Airbnb problem. But Airbnb problem is interesting because at its sort of simplest level, it's not a problem. There's excess capacity, lots of couches and beds that could be occupied by people who don't want to spend hotel rates. But the other problem is a lot of cities deeply depend on the tax revenue from hotels. And if people are going to start staying in apartments at a large scale rather than hotels, and it actually shifts demand away from hotels, then cities are going to lose a lot of revenue, and they're not going to be able to pave the streets or pay for police or pay for teachers. And there's going to be a big problem there. And where is that revenue going to come from? Is it going to have to come from some new real estate tax? Whether or not that's going to have that kind of effect, I think, is a real concern for certain cities.
Back to the issue of the so-called civil rights, these companies, they're not necessarily really sharing profits. They're just big corporations, mostly traded on Wall Street, giving a little bit of money to their various people who share in tiny amounts. How can they make this argument?
Well, you know, look, modesty is not the sort of attribute that makes one a corporate CEO. You know, to lead that kind of life, to choose that life, almost necessitates a stunning amount of arrogance. And so we should expect that. And in this case, though, they see themselves as coming from the future. People who worked so hard for civil rights were fighting the past, fighting for a better future. And so they see themselves in that sense. You know, they are liberated from and liberating people from superstitions and bigotries and old ways of thinking and calcified business models, all of which seems to be, to them anyway, what happened in the civil rights movement, but it's a very poor sense of what actually happened in the civil rights movement. So, you know, that's kind of where they're coming from. But Uber's position on one of the most important civil rights laws of the last 40 years, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act, is, yes, of course, individual drivers should follow the Americans with Disabilities Act, but they are not our employees, so Uber as a company need not follow that law. Uber as a company need not be held responsible for the fact that the drivers clearly violate the law. You know, and that's just a stunning level of arrogance in its own sense, and a stunning lack of concern for the needs of people who we as a people have said deserve equal access to these sorts of facilities. So, you know, it's a really sad comment on where we are in terms of how we discuss politics, history, and civil rights, that we get that tangled and that confused about what actually is going on with civil rights.
Well, Siva Vaidyanathan, it's great to have you back here on the Scholar Circle. I'm looking forward to seeing how this unfolds and talking again very soon.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.